So welcome everyone to our weekly Torah study on the Torah reading that we read on the Parsha. This is what we read all week, and of course on Shabbat we read all seven sections, and we call that the Parsha, the portion, the Sedra of the week. And every day, Sunday through Shabbos, we study one of the portions. On Shabbat, there are seven people called to the Torah, because you divide the Torah reading into seven, first, second, third, fourth, etc., to the seventh reading. So each day of the week, Sunday, you read the first part, Monday the second, Tuesday the third, Wednesday the third, etc. Shabbos, you repeat all seven. They're read publicly in the synagogue, but they're studied privately all week long. Hence the famous expression of the first Rebbe of Chabad that a Jew must live with the times. What did he mean by living with the times? He didn't mean the LA Times or the New York Times or the Washington Times, even if they were good objective papers, which they're not. That's not what he meant. The first Rebbe of Chabad, Shnei Zalman of Liadi, also known as the Alter Rebbe, he said a Jew lives with the daily prescription, guide for life, found in the weekly Torah reading. Sunday's lessons, you read the Sunday reading, Monday you read the Monday readings. Because the Torah, for the Jewish people, is not a book of history, or stories, or philosophy, or wisdom, but it's a guide to life itself. And Jews always believed that the events, we're going to ask everybody to mute themselves so we don't get feedback. We'll stop later on, periodically, and I'll open up for questions. So the Torah is the blueprint for the Jewish life, and Jews always believe that the events, world events, personal events in our lives, are reflected, are found somewhere in the text of the weekly Torah reading. And the great mystics would show you the connections between, let's say, the festivals of the week that landed in a given Torah reading, how they are directly either mentioned or alluded to in the Torah reading. And the same thing with world events. Great mystics would find world events directly reflected, hinted to in the weekly Torah reading, and also personal events in their lives. So on that theme, we approach a fascinating Torah reading called Balak. And that's interesting in of itself because it's named after a Gentile. A Balak, a king, who was an anti-Semite. Now, he wasn't as big as anti-Semite as the other guy in the story, but he was plenty anti-Semite. We'll talk, in fact, this Torah reading is a case study in anti-Semitism. And you could spend a few hours just talking about that. We will just briefly point out a few observations because we want to get to the heart of the story. It's an epic story. It is a epic drama that unfolds. We won't have time to get into all the details. Like everything, we got to laser focus onto one detail of the story so that we can learn something from it. We do a microscopic analysis of the story. Of course, there's layer upon layer. There's infinite depth because we're talking about the wisdom of God. This is not a line in Shakespeare. This is the wisdom of God. It's infinite. And that's why every year you can study it and go a little deeper and deeper and deeper. So we have to at some point say, enough is enough, otherwise we'll be here all night. So the story unfolds like a Greek drama. Fascinating. You got heroes, anti-heroes, and people who are tragic in their humanity, in that there is a tension between human freedom, free choice, and destiny. Are things predestined? Is there such a thing as destiny? Are we granted free choice? Is there a conflict between the two? Can we lose our free choice? Can we become entrapped? Sometimes we make our own destiny, and sometimes we entrap ourselves. We become victims of our own, of the consequences of our own choices. And that's the kind of the Greek tragedy that plays out in this week's Torah reading with Balak and Bilam. So I'll give a little intro and we'll go inside. We have a lot of text today, more than usual, and because it's kind of necessary to understand the story, to follow the text. I got a Hebrew on one side. If you don't read Hebrew, just ignore it. There's English translation on the left. I'll be going through both. But I feel that the text is really critical to understanding the drama, the tragedy, the irony that is underlying this epic story. And also, we know that Jews have never read, and I'll repeat it again, we have never read the Bible as is. The literal reading of the Bible in any language, and certainly any language other than Hebrew, is absolutely a useless exercise. Why do I say that? As you know, because that's not the Torah. You're reading the Bible. Jews have never, ever, from Moses day one through to today, no Jewish scholar ever read the Torah that way. Our Torah came with a manual, a companion, the Cliff Notes, explaining every word, every letter, every law. That's called the Oral Law. That is the bulk of the body of the material of the Talmud. It was called the Oral Law because for centuries it was prohibited to be written down, was memorized, passed from teacher to student, from father to son, until it was written down. That's history for another time. Now it's recorded in the Talmud, in the Medrash, etc. And that's how we read the Torah. We never read the Torah, because the Torah is a message to the Jewish people. So it's encoded, it's encrypted. And the only way to decrypt the meaning is to look into the Talmud or the Medrash. The first commentator, biblical commentator in Jewish history, who wrote a commentary distilling the spirit of the oral law, of the commentary, the in-between the lines, because what you read in the literal lines is not Judaism. Never was, never will be. The first one to ever do that was the great Solomon ben Isaac Rashi, the father of all commentators, very special man. We don't have time to get into him, but he's one of the giants of Judaism. 1100s, actually 11th century. He died at the turn of the 1105. He died. Great, great man. And whether you're a five-year-old kid or a 95-year-old Talmudic scholar, you understand the text of the Torah only by studying it with Rashi. And no parsha is as so relevant as in this week's Torah portion. And that's why, I've got a lot of text. I got a lot of Rashi commentary, all in English, to show you how he captures all the nuance and the pathos and the irony. All the drama is captured in Rashi. And Rashi was a master. You know, he could say 3-4 words and capture the whole story. So we're going to do the text of the Torah with the distillation of the commentary known as Rashi. And then I'll put it all together. I'll ask a bunch of questions and then we'll piece it all together. It's about like a puzzle. And we'll be the detectives together. And I'll stop periodically. So if I lose you along the way, you got any questions, jot them down. When I stop, you can fire away. So let's get the text. Okay. Let's share the text and we'll get rolling. Okay. So it's called Parshat Balak. So our story will unfold in what I call four scenes or four acts, just like a Greek play. And whoever wrote the script must have been drinking something. Of course, that's what those secular humanists who don't believe the Torah is from God and some guy wrote it, that's what they would conclude. Because in the narrative, God says no, then he says yes. Then he says no, and then he says yes. He changed his mind 4 times. That's not like the image of God that we know. So, secular scholars say, different authors. Nonsense. They missed the whole story. They missed the whole beauty. The nuance, the profundity of the story is lost. When you start looking for different authors, you miss the whole thing. There's an incredible lesson about destiny, about humanity, the nature of humanity, and how we sometimes are our own worst enemies. It's all contained in this story. So what happens? You got the land of Moab and the land of Midian, their neighbors. And they're on the other side of the Jordan. They're outside of Israel. And the Jews are there because they haven't entered Israel yet. It's the end of the 40 years. So they're on the outskirts of civilization. They've come out of the desert 40 years. And you got these two countries, Midian and Moab. Now, actually, right before them were two other nations. And actually, those two other nations were like mercenaries for hire, protection. They were the muscle. And everybody paid them to protect the border, not to let anybody across. Of course, they didn't count on the Jewish people. So Sihon and the Amorites and the kingdom of Sihon and the two kings, when the Jews approached and asked for peaceful passage through their land, they told them absolutely no, and they came out to meet them in war. Moses came out and they defeated them. I think I've got my wrong file open. Okay, we'll have to do. Okay, so these two mercenary nations on the outskirts of civilization, on the outside of Israel, the Amorites and Sihon, had been squarely defeated by the Jewish people on their way out, as they emerged from the wilderness. So now before them are the two unprotected countries of Moab and Midian. And so now they panic. Here we begin the drama. Vayab, Balak, you can read along in the English, guys. Balak saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. Balak was the king of Moab there, the Moabite king. And he just saw on YouTube what the Jews had done to the ancient muscle, the two most powerful nations, the Amorites and Sihon, kingdom of Sihon, very powerful. They were paid protection money to protect the border, and the Jews wiped them out like they were nothing. So now, Balak is in a panic. Now, the truth is, he's in panic for no reason, because God has already told the Jewish people, don't provoke, do not attack the Moabites. And the reason God did that is because there's going to be a great descendant out of Moab. Ruth, the grandmother of David, she will convert to Judaism. So God says, don't touch the Moabites. So they had nothing to worry about. So Balak is an anti-Semite. He doesn't like the Jews. But he's got some kind of he's got an official reason why he hates them. But like many anti-Semites who use some kind of excuse as a rational justification for their hatred, it's really irrational. Because he had no reason to fear. God already told the Jews, don't touch the Moabites. We weren't going to go anywhere near them. Rashi comments, the king Balak, he saw everything that they had done to the Amorites. He said, these two kings, when we relied on, could not resist. They, they were defeated by the Jews. So we certainly cannot. So he was terrified. That's why he was terrified. The muscle has been taken out. So what chance do we stand? They were terrified. I'm just going to check one thing, guys. I think I may have opened the wrong file. Let me double check really quickly. Okay, well, let's just work with it for now. And if we have a problem, we'll make it up as we go along. Okay, so that's the... So, consequently, the Moabites were terrified. Okay, so Moab became terrified of the Jewish people, for they were numerous, and they took out the muscle. The two kingdoms who were paid protection money. So the Moabites send a message to their neighbors, the Midianites, two separate nations, Moab and Midian. Midian is the same place, that's where Moses hung out for about 60 years when he escaped from Egypt. That's where he married the daughter of Jethro, the whole story. Okay, so they sent a message to the elders, now this assembly will eat up everything around us like an ox eats up the green of the field. So the Moabites are totally irrational, as most anti-Semitism is. The Black Plague. Jews observed hygiene. They washed their hands. In general, they washed, they cleaned, they washed before eating. Torah requires cleanliness, Judaism, the observance of hygiene. So we were less prone in some areas to the plague. Of course, in other areas, we die like everybody else. But the irrational mind of the medieval Gentile couldn't handle it. And so they demonized the Jew and wiped them out. Okay? So he says he has this irrational fear. We will come and we'll eat everything in sight. That's absolute nonsense. Based on what? But again, anti-Semitism is an irrational virus that infects you and you're no longer thinking with common sense. But at least Bullock has a reason, a ridiculous reason. Not a reason based in rational reality, but he's got some imaginary reason why he hates the Jews. The Midianites, however, they're invited by Bullock to join in a joint effort to murder the Jews. So the question is, why do the Midianites join? They're not even being threatened. So they were even bigger anti-Semites. That's the bottom line. Two types of anti-Semites, but that's for another time. Rashi says, by the way, says Rashi, this is fascinating that the elders of Midian, the neighboring nation, are even talking to the Moabites, because they hate each other. It's like Iran and the Palestinians. They hate each other. The elders of Midian. But, says Rashi, but didn't they always hate each other? As we know from elsewhere in the Torah, without bringing all the proof, says Rashi, when Midian came against Moab in battle, however, because of their mutual fear and hatred of Israel, they made peace. And that's, of course, not the first. And that became a precedent that even Gentiles who hate each other, they hated the Jew more. So they would join forces. We see that every day with the Arab world. The Arab world has been killing each other for centuries. The only time they're not killing each other is when they're plotting an attack against Israel. And what did Moab see to take counsel with? Why? So now here's another question Rashi deals with. Why does King Bullock of the nation of Moab, why does he go to Midian? Yeah, there is his neighbors. Why does he go there? Of all places. He could go somewhere else. Why was he seeking military counsel from them? And that's because Moses had spent some time there. He wanted to know what was the secret of his power. Since the Moabites saw that Israel was supernaturally victorious, the way the Jews were marching out of Egypt, out of the desert, defied the laws of battle. Didn't follow any traditional, conventional rules of war. It was supernatural. They had some kind of supernatural force. It's called God. So Balak is very concerned. Maybe Moses is a very powerful sorcerer or something like that. We want to find out what's the source, what's his secret identity? What's his Achilles heel? Well, let's ask the Midianites. He spent decades there. Maybe they know what the power of Moses is, so that we could somehow neutralize Moses and defeat these Jews. Okay, they said the leader of the Jews was raised in Midian. He spent a long time there. Let us ask them, what's his power? What's the secret power of Moses, who's leading these Jews? We can figure that out. We can neutralize the Jews. So they told him, his power is solely in his mouth. Prayer. He's a prophet. He speaks to God. He says prayers. That's his power. You're thinking he's some kind of Samson, Hercules, some kind of warrior, gladiator? No. He's got a spiritual power. When he speaks, people listen. He speaks with wisdom. He speaks to God. God speaks to him. He prays. He teaches. That's his power. It's a spiritual power, not a physical power. They said, we too will attack him, come against him, with a man whose strength is in his mouth. So what we need is someone who is the equivalent of Moses. Along comes the next villain in our story, Bilam. Bilam is a prophet. What is the nature of his prophecy? It's a big discussion amongst the commentators. But in simple terms, God always makes things fair. If you got someone as holy as Moses, you got to have someone on the other side as unholy as Bilam. So he is the reverse. It's kind of like, remember Superman, then there was Superman, the reverse Superman. He is the reverse of Moses. Power of prophecy, but an unholy man. Moses was holy, and we'll soon see how they are opposites, diametrically opposed. But Bilam had some kind of power, some kind of prophetic power. What exactly was the nature of his power is not the subject of today, but what he was, he had a reputation that he had power with his mouth, that he could curse people, curse nations. He was a hired gun, a hired assassin. So basically, the Midianites and the Moabites are going to hire this sorcerer for hire, since conventional military warfare won't work against the Jews. They have a supernatural power. They need some kind of supernatural power to counter Moses. So they go to Bilam. Okay? That's the context of our drama. Okay, so they come to Bilam. So what happens is, Balak the king, he sends some representatives of the nation of Moab, but he's really representing both nations by now, and he sends them off to Bilam, this famed prophet, Gentile prophet, a very debased, degenerate, and unholy person. But he's got some kind of power. And they want to harness his power to verbally attack the Jews, to curse them, put a curse on them, to do whatever he does, do his voodoo, whatever it is that Bilam does, do it to the Jews, because we have no other way of fighting them. So the representatives come to him and he tells them, I'm summarizing a bit of the story, he says, look, I can't answer you now. It's daytime. God doesn't talk to me during the day. We'll see later on a bit more about that. He only comes to me at night. So spend the night. I'll ask God. We'll see what he says. So God comes to Bilam. God says to Bilam, you shall not go with them. Okay, act one. What's God's response to Bilam's new job offer? Take it or don't take it. No way. And in general, it was a chutzpah. It was impudence of the greatest degree, hubris of the greatest possible expression, to reproach God and say, hey, do you mind if I curse your children, your people that you love? So of course God says, and I put it in red, you shall not go with them. Don't go. And the name of God used, by the way, is Elohim, which means judge. This is, God is being very stern with Bilam. Okay? Straight answer. No. Can I go to the movies and come back 1 a.m.? No. God is direct and he's very point blank. Bilam, do not go. So, end of act one. Bilam wants to take the job to curse the Jews. He asks God and God refuses him flatly. No, you're not going. Got that? You can't curse them because they're blessed. You cannot go. Okay. So in the morning, what is this for you, Mom? So in the morning, Bilam gets up and he tells the Balak's messengers, he says, go back to your country. Go back to the king, for the Lord has refused to let me go with you. Okay? He said, go back, I can't go. But the truth is, the words are very carefully chosen. He didn't tell them the whole truth. Look what he said. He didn't say, God didn't let me go. He said, God didn't let me go with you. Look what Rashi points out. See, without Rashi, you would miss the nuance, the drama. Only it's you, you're the problem. God won't let me go because you're not worthy of me. This is a very arrogant man. That's why he's the opposite of Moses. Moses is supremely holy because he's supremely humble, no ego. This man is supremely unholy because he's supremely arrogant and egotistical. Only with greater nobles than you. This shows us that he was conceited, the opposite of Moses, and unwilling to reveal that he was under the control of God, except in an arrogant manner. So he was arrogant and he wouldn't admit the truth to these nobles, these dignitaries. God won't let me go. He said, no, finish. End the story. Nothing to discuss. Go home. Can't tear up the contract. I can't accept the contract. No, instead he said he didn't. He was too arrogant to admit that. His pride wouldn't let him tell the truth. So he says, God, I can't go with you. I need more distinguished, more dignified. When you send me more important nobles, higher ranking, then maybe we can talk. You getting the picture of Bilam here a little bit? Okay, moving on. Scene 2, Act 2. Now, the strange thing in Act 2, what was God's response? Can you go? Can you accept the contract to murder my people? Obviously, no. No way. Forget about it. Absolutely no. But in scene 2, God says yes. Let's have a look. The mystery thickens. So Balak gets the hint that Bilam wants more honor. He's got a big ego. So Balak continues to send dignitaries more and higher in rank than the first guys. So he sends even a bigger delegation of even higher ranking dignitaries from the palace, because that's what the guy wants. The guy's got a massive ego. So Balak is humoring Bilam's ego. And then the same thing happens again. They come, and Bilam tells them, look, and spend the night. God doesn't talk to me during the day. He only appears to me at night. So you got to spend the night anyway. Let's see what he says, and I'll tell you in the morning. So, now, says the Torah, God came to Bilam at night. And he says to him, if these men have come to call for you, you know, they want your services. So arise in the morning and go with them. Oh! What just happened? There's an inconsistency in the script. In scene one, God says, don't go, don't even think about it. No, flat no. Now, suddenly God changes his mind. And God says, if they've come to hire you, you can go with them. But here's the catch. The word I speak to you, that you shall do, you can only follow my orders. But if you want to go with them, you can go with them. So, again, we're getting a little bit of the difficulty. God seems to be changing his mind. What's going on here? But it gets even better. Act 3. So in the morning, right, this is the second group of dignitaries. They've spent the night. God visits Bilam at night, gives him the message. Now in the morning, Bilam gets up and God has told him he can go, right? So he saddles his donkey, a she-donkey, with the Moabite dignitaries, and off he goes. So he's got the green light from God. First God said no. Now God changed his mind. He said yes. So Bilam quickly saddles his donkey in the morning, and he's in a hurry to do this. You know, he's a very important man. He got no one else to saddle the donkeys, but he's so excited about cursing the Jews, he cannot wait. He does it himself. Okay. Now, I'll come back to this Rashi later. I'm going to skip it now. I'm going to go through the whole narrative, hit you with the four scenes, the four acts, and all the contradictions. Then we'll go back over it and explain it all on three levels. Now, remember, Act 2, you got to pay attention, guys. The plot thickens. In Act 2, God has told Bilam, if they've come to hire you for the job, accept, go with them. She's got the green light now in scene 2. But now as we switch again, look at this. Bilam just got the green light from God. So he saddles his donkey and off he goes. Look at the reaction of God. And God's wrath flared. He got angry. Why? Because he was going. What do you mean he was angry because he was going? You just told him to go. As all the commentators ask, what's going on? It's completely self-contradictory. God just told him, if they've come to hire you, you can go. I give the green light. Even though in scene 1 I told you no, now I'm telling you you can go. So now in scene 3, or part of scene 1, scene 2, God's upset. What is he upset for? He just told him to go. Make up your mind. Talking about a unstable God. Okay, now because God's angry, he seems to intervene. What does he do? An angel of the Lord stationed himself on the road to thwart him. In Hebrew, it's an interesting word. Okay, it's not there. The Hebrew word is le-satan. That's where the Christians got the word Satan from, by the way. By them, he's an independent contractor who rebels against God. In Judaism, that's sheer nonsense. There's only one supreme being running the universe. There is no one else sitting on the board. It's only God. And this angel works for God like all the other angels. He doesn't rebel. He only does what God tells him to do. And God sent him here to thwart him, to block him. That's what Satan is. He's the angel that blocks your path when you're trying to do something usually good. You're on your way to synagogue, and he comes up with an excuse. Why not to get to synagogue? That's the Satan's job. Okay? And that comes from here. To thwart. Says Rashi. He was upset because he was going. Bilam saw that this was considered evil by God, and yet he wanted to go to thwart him. Why would God send an angel to thwart him? The plot thickens. It was an angel of mercy. Interesting. Rashi tells us. The angel was there not to make trouble. The angel there was there out of an act of mercy. But what on earth does that mean? Again, I'm going to keep asking a few more questions and I'll explain it all by the end. And he wanted to, because he wanted to prevent Bilam from sinning so he wouldn't be destroyed. In other words, this was a mercy mission. Despite the fact that he was disobedient, God sent him an angel to stop him. Okay, so we've got some confusion here. God keeps changing his mind, but the plot thickens even further. Because now, Bilam, the prophet, he's on his way to the king, and he's riding a donkey. And that's a whole drama in and of itself. We won't go into all the details. But what happens is that the donkey is permitted by God to see the angel. Bilam, the so-called world-famous prophet, can't see past his nose. He didn't see anything on the road. So the donkey turns off to the side to avoid the angel, and Bilam loses his cool. He loses composure, and he starts beating the donkey. Here's the drama, the next scene. The donkey saw the angel standing there on the road and had a sword. He wasn't planning to walk into a sword. Even a donkey knows what a sword's for. I don't plan to be, you know, donkey steak for dinner. So the donkey moves away off the road into the field, which is normal. He sees the donkey turned aside from the road. So Bilam's on a road, on a path. Donkey turns off to the side. Bilam beats the donkey to get it back onto the road. Bilam's on a path. Donkey goes off the road, off the path, takes a detour. He beats the donkey to get it back on the road. He has no idea what's got into the donkey because he doesn't see anything. Which begs the question, who's the real donkey here, right? If the donkey can see the angel and the prophet can't see, who's the real donkey? Which is part of the point that God is sending a message to Bilam. Rashi, the donkey, saw. But Bilam did not see, for God permitted a beast to perceive, to see more than a human being. So who's the real donkey here, right? Okay, continuing the drama. The angel of God stands in the path of the vineyard with a fence on this side and a fence on this side. So now there's nowhere to go. There's a fence on either side. So he's blocking completely. There's a little move room on either side to move, but not too far because there's a fence on either side. So the donkey's got very little leg room. So the donkey panics. It sees the angel standing there. What does it do? It presses against the wall because it's trying to get out of the way of the angel, and that sword looks very sharp. So while she does that, she presses Bilam's leg against the wall. So his leg is being crushed against the wall now. And he doesn't know why. So he beats the donkey again. So the angel of God continues going ahead, and he stands in a narrow place. Now he's in a much narrower spot, cutting off the donkey. Now there's no room to move. No room to move, to turn neither right nor to the left. So donkey's stuck. Okay, and then now Bilam really loses his cool. He's beating the donkey more and more. So finally, God says, enough of this game. And he opens up the mouth of the donkey. And the donkey says to Bilam, why have you hit me three times? You beat me up three times. What did I do to you? Now, if you and I, just by the way, if you and I heard a donkey talking to us, how would you react? I don't know about you, but I'd probably run for the border. I'd be in shock. I wouldn't sit around and have a conversation with a donkey. But it tells you something about Bilam that he starts talking to the donkey. He thinks this is normal. He's having a conversation with a donkey. Anyway, Bilam says to the donkey, because you have humiliated me. Again, we're getting a character portrait of this man that is very, very clear. He is the personification of conceit, arrogance, haughtiness, pride, ego. He's a megalomaniac. And he detests nothing more than being publicly disgraced and humiliated. And the donkey humiliated him. You humiliated me. If I had a sword in my hand, I would have killed you. Now you have to understand, who's watching all this? The dignitaries from the king, they're watching all this. So he's totally humiliated. And as Rashi points out, look what he just said. If I had a sword in my hand, wow, what kind of a powerful sorcerer prophet are you if you can't kill a donkey? You got a sword in your hand. Look what Rashi says. This matter greatly disgraced him in the eyes of the dignitaries. This man was going to kill an entire nation, supposedly, right? With his mouth. And yet, for his donkey, he needed weapons. So that the ministers of Moab were having second thoughts about this guy. He can't even kill a donkey. How's he going to kill a whole nation for us? Okay. Let me just check on our time here. Leave enough time to wrap it all up by the end. I'm just going to continue the drama, then we'll wrap it all up. Okay. So Bilam says to the angel of God, I have sinned. I did not know you were standing there. Now here is act four. He asks the angel, okay, I messed up. I sinned. I didn't know you were there. So he asks him a question. Same question Bilam's been asking over and over again. And he's been asking God the same question over and over again. And now he's asking God as well, but just through the angel. If it displeases you, If you, are you unhappy about this whole project of going to curse the Jews? Do you want me to go back? Just let me know and I'll return. Tell me what to do. He's asking the same question a fourth time. Listen to what the angel says. We'll skip that part. We'll go on. The angel of God said to Bilam, go with these men. Oh, he got another yes. So we start off with a no, with the first guys. Then he says, God changes his mind, says, you can go. He starts going with the donkey. God said, God gets angry at him. And now he asks God a fourth time. And what does God say? Yes, go. So it's yes. First it's no, yes, no, yes. What's going on here? Everyone see the drama here? Okay. Okay, so let me give you three explanations of what's going on, and we'll take a look at it. Is everybody clear on the question? God doesn't seem to know what he wants. What is it that God wants from Bilam? He wants him to go? Or he doesn't want him to go? First he tells him, no way, no, blank. Then he tells him, you want to go? You can go. Then when he's on the way, he gets angry. And then when he has the trouble, the encounter with the angel, he asks the angel point blank, well, if you're upset, let me know. I'll go back home. I'll turn around. No, you can go. What's going on? Okay. Three explanations. There are many more, but we'll suffice with three. And there are several commentators who deal with the first one, the second one, and the third one. I'll skip the names just to make it easy. First answer, we're going to look at it inside, I'll explain it, then we'll look at it. And then we'll look at, and I'll explain the second one, we'll look at it inside, and then the punchline will be the third one, which is my favorite, the third one. We'll notice that the first line that God tells them to go with the, when he gets the first okay to go. The first time, God says, do not go with them. Then after he says, you can go with them. The word for with them in Hebrew used in those two responses is not the same, as I'll show you in a moment. The first time when God says, do not go with them, in Hebrew it's im, aleph mem. I'll show it to you in just a moment. In the other case where he says, you can go with them, he uses a different word for with. In Hebrew, aleph tof, s. I'll show it to you in a moment. What's the difference between those two words? So several commentators point out, and it's actually in Rashi, which I'll show you in a moment too. In, let's imagine people traveling on a plane together to Miami. There's a whole family traveling for, let's say, for a wedding, for a simcha. And then there's a bunch of, you know, Jewish people traveling together for an Orthodox wedding, a big simcha, and you got a bunch of, you know, grad students who are going, you know, for the, they do their crazy parties there in Florida. You know, I forgot what they call them. And they go wild. So they're all on the plane. So if you were asked, the Jewish family, did those students travel with you? Yes, they were with us. They were on the plane. But they weren't really with them, were they? They were with them circumstantially. but there was no intimate association between the two groups. One group was separate. Circumstances, they were on the same plane together. They were traveling, you know, to have a wild time over there in Miami. And the other group, those family members, they were traveling with each other, together. It was an intimate association of family members traveling together. When you use the word im in Hebrew, it means with them in spirit, in heart, in mind, intimate association. We're really together in heart and spirit. When you use the other word et, Aleph Tof, and I'll show you the two words in a moment, it means superficial. I'm on the road together with them, but it's circumstantial. We don't have the same goal or agenda objective. So when God told them, told Bilam the first time, he said, don't go. He said, don't go with them. There's no way you can accept that job and be together with them in their plot and conspiracy to murder my Jewish people. But as we'll see later on, at the end of the day, God doesn't stand in your way. He tells you what's the right thing to do, like a good parent should, but like a good parent, you got to stand back. You can't be an elevated parent. You got to stand back and allow your kids to fall, to make their own mistakes. So God eventually tells him, you want to go? I already told you what my opinion is. You want to go? You go. But don't, if you want to just go with them, okay, but no, don't be part of their conspiracy. There God uses the word et, the superficial association. You can travel the same road with them, but don't you dare ever consider of being part of their scheme. Of course, did he listen? He didn't. He went with them, despite what God told him, but together with them in heart and spirit. He was, in fact, a bigger anti-Semite than they were. That's one answer. Let's have a look, and I'll give you the second one. Okay. Let's have a look. Let's go back to the beginning. Got a lot of text here. Is everybody still there? For some reason, I don't see. Oh. Okay. I got to do it the other way. That's why I lost everybody. Sorry. Okay. Come on. Let's go back to the beginning. A lot of text here. Let's have a look. Okay. Let's moving up towards through the text here. They were numbers that came, said to the media, now will EWK. That's the accusation. And as we move along, and then God finally says to them, do not go. Let's have a look here quickly. Come on, come on, come on. Okay. You shall not go with them. If you notice here in the Hebrew, guys, the word for with them is the word, where's the mouse? Imahem, aleph mem, hey mem, with them. That's the word that means together, intimately. Same mind, same heart, same spirit, same objective, same agenda. You're all on the same page. Don't go with them like that. To curse? No way. That's an absolute no. Moving on. I'll show you one more example of that. I'll move on to the next one. Look what Rashi says. To go with you. Only on, not the wrong one. Moving on. A little bit further. Night and said to him, God says to him, oh, look what he says in the Hebrew. God came to him in the night when the second group, the more distinguished higher-ranking dignitaries came. So he came to the knight. He told him, get up, leich, go, itam, aleph taf. That reply is superficial. You want to walk with them side by side on the same road? I got no problem with that, says God. You can go alongside them, but not with them. As long as you're not with them in heart and spirit. And I'll show you one last. And what does he do? He gets up in the morning, he saddles his donkey, and he went with them. What God just told him, you want to go along with them? As long as you're not part of their conspiracy, you can go with them. That's okay. As long as you're not really with them. But in the next verse, it says he saddled his donkey and he went with them. In Hebrew, look in the Hebrew. Vayelech im, aleph mem, close intimate association. Where we go? Where's the mouse? Right there. Im, that's the word for close associate. He violated the warning. Look what Rashi says. Aleph mem, with the Midianite dignitaries. His intent was the same as theirs. God says, I'll let you. You want to travel with them? I got no problem. As long as you're not part of their scheme. What does he do? He travels. He's part of their scheme. And that explains all the discrepancies. So that's one interpretation. There's another. I'll explain it. Then I'll show it to you. Let's get rid of this. Oh. Anybody got any questions on that? You got it? Explanation number two. You notice something. Bilam, if you have to characterize him, how would you characterize him? Complete egomaniac, as most evil people are. His one concern is being humiliated, right? It's all about prestige, honor, ego, conceit. He's arrogance personified, which is why he is the antithesis. He's the reverse image of Moses. Moses, most humble man on the face of the earth. Moses has no ego to speak of. He's transparent. If you walked on him, he wouldn't say anything. Bilam's the opposite. So here's what one Hasidic master, mystic Kabbalist, explains. God decided to use Bilam. Now, he's a very unholy tool. You can't compare when a friend or a family member gives a praise. You know, your mom says, you wrote an essay, you come home, your mom says, oh, what a beautiful essay you wrote. It's Shakespeare. Could be. But if your mom said it, who knows? She's your mother after all, right? If you take it to your next door neighbor who hates you with a passion, and he tells you that this piece you wrote, oh, it's poetry, then you know it's a legitimate compliment, correct? Follow? So God says, I want powerful blessings on my people. It's no trick to get Moses to bless them. I want to get the lowest element in the world to praise the Jews, Bilam the evil. He's the wrong tool to be a vehicle for the divine presence, for Shekhinah. You got to be like Moses, humility. That's exactly why God chose him to be. You need a modem to download, to transfer the data that we call Torah, divine wisdom, from God's brain, mind to human mind. You need a modem, a go-between. That modem was Moses. Because you need a modem, you need a human being who's on the one hand, the highest form of human intellect known to man, that was Moses, as Maimonides explains. At the same time, he's got to have no ego. That's a very unique combination. You follow? So Moses was the perfect modem. So how is God going to overcome the problem? You see, ego is the greatest block to God. If you got ego, God doesn't go anywhere near you. That's a rule. You have no ego, God is fully revealed. That's why Moses was the conduit for the divine revelation. So God wants to use Bilaam to channel these powerful blessings upon the Jewish people, which in the end, if you read the rest of the story, that's exactly what happened. He opened his mouth, and just like God opened the mouth of the donkey, God opened the mouth of Bilaam, and whatever God wanted, he dictated through his mouth. But he's not worthy. He's a broken vessel. God has to fix him, otherwise he can't use him. Well, what's the biggest problem with Bilaam? Arrogance. So God has to make a shmata out of him. Got to break him. Got to humiliate him. Has to disgrace him. And that's what we've been reading. And that's why God wouldn't let him go with the first set of dignitaries. Because to be humiliated by low-level dignitaries isn't the biggest humiliation possible. And in order to make Bilaam a modem for the blessings that God's going to channel through him, he's got to break him completely. So God says, don't go with those nobles. Wait. When the bigger, higher-ranking nobles came, and then God completely humiliated him. A donkey saw more than the great prophet. He was supposed to be the great seer. He couldn't see past his nose. The donkey could see. There was an angel right there. He saw nothing. And he had to admit it. At the end, he said, I'm sorry, I sinned. I didn't know. He was forced to publicly admit, I'm the one, I said, I know the mind of God. And it turns out I know nothing. So he was completely, his ego was obliterated. Perfect, explains the Kabbalist. Now he could be the modem, the channel through which God could send the blessings to the Jewish people. You follow? Answer number two. My favorite is answer number three. Because this one weaves through the text like a tapestry and puts it all together. Remember, we've got Act 1, 2, 3, and 4. No, yes, no, yes. What's going on? I'll explain it. I'll show it to you inside. And actually, this explanation appears almost twice in the text, as I'll show you. The nature of free choice and destiny. There is such a thing as destiny. If you will, God is the screenwriter. All of history is a screenplay. And there's a plot, a divine, a cosmic plot. And nobody can change it. Because there's only one producer, one director in the universe. That's one of the fundamental principles of Judaism. He's in full control. There is no one else on the board. He's the CEO, and there is no one else. As he says, in Kamoini Baretz, I'm the supreme being. And therefore, what happens is God writes a script, and he writes a cast. Hero, villain, big villain, big hero, little hero. But God does not dictate, he does not do the casting. He creates the roles. We volunteer for the roles. And that's where human freedom, choice comes in. And this is the way it works. You're faced with a moral dilemma. Doing something which is, in Bilaam's case, it's an extreme. And of course, we all face this on different levels. Not always as extreme, but for dramatic sake, Bilaam is facing the ultimate choice. He's about to do something terribly vicious, vindictive, pure anti-Semitism. He's going to murder the Jews, so he thinks. It's an attack an unwarranted, unprovoked attack on the Jewish people. He's opposed to the Jewish people simply because they exist. Nothing new. They haven't done anything to him. There's no history between him and the Jewish people. So he's got a choice. Accept the job, do something terrible, which he must know. He's not a complete idiot. That God, I mean, it's a chutzpah to even ask God. Right? That was already the first mistake. But look, God was patient with him. He listened to the question and he gave him a straight answer. And God didn't mess around. The answer was blunt. No. So the consequences of not following that are clear. If you disregard this, you're heading for self-destruction. That's what you're going to do. You're on a collision course with me. But the way it works is no matter how serious the choice or serious the consequence, God does not interfere. He does not obstruct your path. Because that is the nature of the world that God created. He gave us the gift that only he can grant. Only God has free choice. And that's why it says he made man in his image. He created clones, beings that have free choice like him. That's human beings. That's how we're godlike. We can choose our destiny. Only human beings can do that. So God, but see, God doesn't set you adrift without a GPS. Go figure it out. He gives you a Torah. He's very direct, explicit. In the case of Bilam, he told him straight, no. He didn't negotiate it, didn't discuss it. Point blank, no. He was a very articulate and good parent, straight. But Bilam chose to disagree, to disregard. Why? Because he had an ego. He wanted the glory, he wanted the honor. He wanted all the money. They promised him a king's ransom. He wanted the money. He was greedy. He was arrogant. He was all the worst human qualities rolled into one person, right? He couldn't help himself. So the second time God says, you want to go? I'll let you go. So God backs off. Because that's what God does. He leaves you room. But then God has rachmanis, God has compassion. You're on a path now that leads to self-destruction. So God sends the angel of mercy. You've chosen to go on a path. You're already on the road. By the way, the symbolism of a donkey, in Hebrew, a donkey is chamor, which means materialism. When you're riding on your donkey, it means you've chosen the path of materialism, following the physical body, not the spirit. So he's on the path, but God has compassion for every creature, even for Bilam. Bilam's evil. He's still a human being. So he sticks an angel on the road to block his path, an angel of mercy, we were told, to try to get him to take a detour. But Bilam is stubborn. Right? Bilam is stubborn. He, despite the act of mercy, God is now interfering, trying to block him a little bit, creating some roadblocks so that this path of destruction shouldn't be so easy to take. But he's determined. He perseveres. There's perseverance for good, perseverance for evil. Bilam perseveres. He gets around the angel. He beats the donkey. He doesn't care. Keeps on moving. Well, at the end of the day, you're in control of your destiny. So what does the angel do? He stands aside. He asks the angel, well, do you want me to go back? It's too late at that point. At that point, God says, you've chosen. I told you no. I tried to give you a hint along the, you know, you're on the way to commit a crime and you got a flat tire. Maybe that's a message from God. You shouldn't rob the bank. That's exactly what happened to Bilam. He's on the way to rob a bank. He gets a flat tire. The donkey doesn't want to cooperate. It's a message from God. It's an angel. It's an act of mercy. He won't pay attention. Well, third step, at the third stage, God stands back, opens all the roads. You're free to go. You've decided. You're a human being. That's your choice. And you have to live with the consequences. Of course, he does self-destruct at the end. So let's have a quick look. By the way, that's why at first he says, don't go. Then he says, okay, if you want to go, go. Then he tries to give him compassion to deter him. That doesn't work. Finally, he says, okay, go. It's that tension between granting choice and trying to help you make the right decision is hinted to in the fourth act, the story of the donkey. If you will see in a second, if you remember in the beginning, the donkey tries to seize the angel obstructing. What does the donkey do? He turns off the path. There is still a path you can still take a detour. Early enough in when you're on a wrong path, you're on a bad path of destruction. At the early stage, there's still a detour, a field you can turn into to get off the road. In the beginning, the donkey gets off the road, and Bilam is beating him to get back on the path. I want to be on this path, says Bilam. So now it gets more narrow. Your choices narrow through your own choice. You become committed to the crime you're about to commit. So what happens? Now there's a wall on either side. There isn't so much room to move. A little bit of room, but not too much. And again, the angel's blocking, and the donkey's trying to wiggle away from the road. And he beats him more. Keep going. Well, if you still don't get the message, you got a flat tire, your windshield burst, and you're still headed to rob the bank. So what happens now? In the end of that scene with the donkey, it says the angel stood in a narrow spot on the road with no room to move to the right or the left. You hear what the Torah is telling you? If you proceed on a path of destruction, despite knowing that it is, God's told you, get off that road. And you proceed, you put yourself in a narrow spot from which you cannot return. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. It becomes inevitable. Now, you're in a narrow spot, you can't move to the right or the left, you're stuck. And the inevitable happens. So, what seems to be a self-contradictory story is actually a powerful insight into how God runs the universe and the power of humanity for salvation and also for self-destruction. Let's have a quick look and then we'll conclude. Oops, not that way. I'll just show it to you inside quickly. Okay, what did I do here? Out of the way. Okay, put this over here. Let me show you that last one. Let's go by the end of Rashi. By the end. By the end. Oh. There it is. Okay, so he asked the angel, should I go? Are you upset with me? Should I go? Should I go back home? What's the story? Remember, he's had all the warnings. Flat tire. Windshield busted. And he's still proceeding forward. He's forging forward on a path of self-destruction. The angel of God says to Bilam, go with the men. I'm not going to stop you. I tried to stop you. You're ignoring me. You still want to go? Then go. You have to understand, this is coming after God told him no. After God told him, you can go with them, but don't go with them really. Go along, but not along with them. And he still ignores, and he blocks them on the way, and he still proceeds. He's forging ahead. So he says, but only do what I tell you to do. But of course, Bilam's not going to do that anyway. Says Rashi, why did the angel tell him, after all the drama, God sends an angel to stop him, to block him, and all the drama, he doesn't see, then he does see. After all that, you would think the angel would tell him, go home. And yet the angel says, go with these men. Says Rashi, here's the key to how God runs the universe. Says Rashi, speaking to his audience, five-year-old kids, a man is led on the path he wishes to follow. You hear that, guys? That's Judaism. A man is led on the path he chooses to follow. Now, God along the way will try his best out of compassion and mercy to obstruct you. Sometimes we're on a project, we're doing something, and we find difficulty at every step, at every turn, obstacles, impediments, complications, and we're not getting the message. It's actually a blessing in disguise. How many times in those stories, there was a lady who used to come to the classes, Helen Carlsberg, who tells the story when she was young and she was traveling and she missed a plane one time. You know, she tells that story, and it was a plane, I don't know if it was a terrorist attack, I don't recall, but it was a plane that never arrived. And her parents were terrified. It turned out, so she thought it was the worst thing that happened to her. She missed her flight. Turned out the best thing that happened to her. But the bottom line is, it's not always as dramatic as that, but God gives us little clues, little messages that we sometimes ignore. He sends us text messages. A flat tire. In Bilam's case, a donkey that doesn't want to cooperate. It's running off the road for no reason. Right? And yet sometimes we ignore those messages. Even though deep down we know we're wrong. Bilam was conscious that he was making a wrong decision. He was so greedy and so driven that he couldn't help himself. Well, he could, but he chose not to help himself. But the end, he couldn't help himself. By the very end, and that's the symbolism, I think, inherent in the donkey story. That the path gets narrower and narrower. At the first stage, he still had an exit. He could get onto the field. And as you go further, it closes in on you. There's a wall on either side. Less wiggling room. And then finally, he's in a narrow place where he cannot budge right or left. You trap yourself. So I think that, really fascinating that the donkey story is actually the clue to unraveling the rest of the story. Because right there in the fabric of the donkey story is this tension of God is the parent watching over us, trying to guide us, but on the other hand, standing clear and aloof and not actually interfering. Because he wants us to be human beings. God wants human beings to create a godly, holy, loving place on earth. But he doesn't want to do it. He wants us to do it. And if we are going to do it, we've got to be humans. So some humans will fall and some will rise. And that's the challenge. But God doesn't leave you without tools. He gives you this Torah. And it gives you the script. He said, listen, look, don't follow Bilam. I will send you angels. Sometimes you'll see him. Sometimes you won't see him. But I will send you angels always to protect you from the hazards of life and from the hazards of your own decisions. But at the end of the day, if we want to be stubborn, that's the power, that's the price of being a human being. We can choose to walk off a cliff, and God won't stop us. He'll try before, right? The car will break down, he'll try to stop you, but if at the end, you know, the car broke down, the engine collapsed, but you get out of the car and you walk off the cliff, he's not going to stop you. That's basically what happened to Bilam. Engine broke down, brakes, everything broke down, he had to get out of the car. So, give up. No, he proceeded and went right off the cliff. That was his choice. So I think this is an incredible, dramatic story that teaches us so much about God and about us. What God is and what God isn't. He does not interfere, but he has complete mercy, and he wants us to succeed. That's why he helps us and guides us. And about the power we have to choose. It's so powerful that we can choose the wrong thing. That's how powerful our choices are. That tells us the incredible power we have to shape our destiny. So have any questions on that before we sign off, guys?
Yes, sure. Rabbi. I always thought that the only free choice we have is whether we're going to do a mitzvah or not. Whether we're going to miss a plane or not, that's preordained. Who we're going to meet is preordained. Whether I'm going to go to shul is my free choice, but how I'm going to get there and if I'm going to get there is preordained.
There's no contradiction. And basically what we said today, well, it's not necessarily a mitzvah, but it's basically whenever you face a moral decision that results in good or evil, then you have freedom of choice. Okay? Now, in the case of Bilam, as we saw, God sent him obstacles. So it could be that's the plane that you miss. You follow? The two can intersect. Yes, the job you get, things like that are not in your decision. But sometimes along the way, again, you're on the way to rob a bank and your car breaks down. Was that an accident? Was that a random event? You could interpret it that way. The Torah would say that's a direct message from God. That's the donkey suddenly running for the field, trying to tell you you're on a path of destruction. And that could be a plane, that could be anything. We have to always, Baal Shem Tov said, the holy Baal Shem Tov said, everything that a Jew sees, hears, or encounters in life is a text message from God. He runs the world. Why were you at this corner? Why were you at this location and you saw this and someone else didn't see it? Or maybe someone else did, but God wanted you to see or hear or find out about this. It's a message from God. What? Well, you have to ask yourself, what am I to learn from this? So why did my car break down? Why did I miss the flight? So, you know, if we think we're in control of our lives, we get upset. Oh, my flat tire. I was supposed to get a job interview. I lost the job. And I'm cursing the universe. Maybe that job wasn't good for you. Maybe God's running the world and he's got a better job planned for you. We have to have a little faith that the being who created the universe can run it without our help. He can run the same universe. The universe has not self-destructed, right? The creator who created that universe can certainly run it without our help. Have to have a little faith. And a lot of faith is also good, but a little faith. Right? Bilam had no faith whatsoever. Because the truth is, and I'll add one last thing. One last thing. You remember Bilam said to the angel, he says, I didn't know you were there. I'm sorry I sinned. I have sinned. I didn't know you were there. So a Hasidic mass asked a simple question. What is Bilam talking about? If he didn't know the angel was there, what kind of sin was it? If he didn't see anything, how is he guilty? There's no sin. If I don't see it, it's not my fault. Good question. So he answers, very simple. Bilam, your donkey is running into the field. Why do you think the donkey's running into the field? You think the donkey has a mind of its own? It runs the universe, the donkey? God runs the universe, including the donkey. The moment, and you're the great prophet, the moment you saw the donkey running into the field and not continuing on the journey, you should have figured it out. You're an idiot, Bilam. You're not a great knower of the mind of God. You saw the donkey running in the field and you thought it was an accident, a coincidence. No coincidence in the universe. Your tire, you got a flat tire? God doesn't want you to go there. The donkey ran off into the field. God doesn't want you to continue. And that was the sin of Bilam. Even before he saw the angel, he should have figured it out. But he didn't. Because you can be blind. Sometimes we choose to be blind. We choose not to see what's right in front of us. He didn't have to see the angel. He could have figured it out from the fact that the donkey ran away, from the fact that his car broke down. That would have been enough of a message. You don't always have to see lightning and thunder, right? Oh, if only lightning and thunder would strike, then I would go to synagogue. Maybe it should be enough that the rabbi called you. Or that there's a funny story. I won't tell you the whole story, but there was, some synagogues, the women's section is upstairs. Men are downstairs. So there were a bunch of women upstairs, and there was a woman leading a prayer service for the ladies, and she had her personal prayer book, and it fell. No, it wasn't. It didn't fall. She had a kid with her. That's what it was. And the kid was a bit of a, we call it Vildachaya. He was a little, a lot of energy, mischievous. And he grabbed his mother's prayer book and he tossed it through the curtain to the gallery down below to the men. So after the services, she went down. It was a personal prayer book. She wanted it back. And she watched all the men coming out. Nobody had his prayer book. Suddenly she sees this young guy coming out with a sitter with her prayer book. She said, "That's my prayer book." He said, "No, it's my prayer book." "What do you mean it's your prayer book?" "Well, I recently returned to Judaism, but I'm not very educated. I don't know how to read too much. I certainly don't know the prayers by heart. And I came late to synagogue. When I arrived at the synagogue, I went to the shelf with all the prayer books. There was not a single prayer book left on the shelf. So I looked up to heaven. I said, 'God, I need a sitter.' And suddenly a sitter flew out of the sky. And landed on my head. That was her sitter. That was her sitter, right? You don't always, a sitter doesn't always have to fly out of the sky to get you out of the synagogue. Sometimes the messages are more subtle. Okay? Rabbi, yes.
I have a question.
Shoot.
It totally confused me. I thought that our destiny was, we don't choose it, that Hashem has already figured out our destiny. And you said the opposite tonight.
Not actually, but I'll say it again. There is a screenplay, a script for the universe and for each of us individually. The individual scripts that intersect with the overall script for the entire cosmos, if you will. Right? That script is written, and you can't change it. Be rich, be poor, where you're going to live, who you're going to marry. Those details, the circumstances, are part of the script, part of a plan, an overall plan. Right. We're a piece in the puzzle. Now, the role that you play in the script, villain, hero, righteous, wicked, saint, sinner, that's your choice. And that we face every day. Every day, the overall script and our personal script, they intersect. And at any moment, we can choose to be the villain of the story or the hero. We can, as Maimonides says, you can save the world or you can destroy the world with one deed. It's up to you. That area, at that point, when we have that moment, we're at that crossroads, that decision, that fateful decision, that we have complete freedom. And that's the story of Bilam. He had complete freedom till the end that he walked off the cliff. That was inevitable. At some point, you can't say, I don't have free choice. If you walk off a cliff and you land and you die, don't say you didn't have choice. You had a choice not to get off, walk off the cliff. But once you walk off the cliff, gravity comes in and you die. You follow? Is that clear?
Yeah, that's clear.
Good. I'll send you the bill.
Yeah, do it. The check is in the mail.
Any other questions? I think this is an amazing story. You can learn a lot from a donkey. It's just hilarious.
Rabbi, if I may make a comment.
Sure.
Was sleeping.
You've made the unintelligible intelligible. You made it. This was a marvelous presentation.
It's a marvelous story, really is. And it shows you how God has a sense of humor, too. Because he showed Bilam, Mr. Big Shot, let me show you who's in control. The donkey will talk and you won't say nothing. The donkey will see and you will be blind as a bat. And that's the price of arrogance. You see? It's a beautiful story, really. It's just a beautiful, beautiful story. Okay, have a wonderful Shabbos, everyone. We'll see you Shabbos, David. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbos. You will. Bye.
Bye.